Record now, and was anything taken? You look at all the beginning?
Probably 3 minutes. We didn't get the very beginning.
Okay, well, we'll start again then. This is the, officially call the Public Institution Committee of the Public Commission of the Oregon Legislature into session. Present today are Commissioner Commissioner Schutte, your attempt check, and Commissioner Representative Boone via phone. It's a work session today for dealing with a number of items before the committee. And first up was our discussion on intergovernmental relationships. At a prior meeting, the committee heard testimony on some proposals by the AOC and LOC to create an intergovernmental affairs relationship, basically with the goal of strengthening the intergovernmental relationship between the legislature and counties, cities, special districts, etc. With us today are Commissioner Leslie Lewis from Yadkin County, who's representing the AOC, Steve Bryant from the League of Oregon Cities, and Tracy Rutten, Breton, who represents the special districts. So, Commissioner Lewis, I think we're going to begin.
Well, very good. Chair Tim Check and commissioners and Representative Boone, it's great to be here today and get a chance to talk to you again. I think we last talked in March, and we brought you about three different proposals. We've now are just going to focus on the Governance Council. A couple of the other items we had appear to be that we need to do some more work on, and potentially that there are issues that could be worked on by the Governance Council. Our concept, again, on the council is that we need to have a stronger relationship between the executive branch, the state legislature, and local government. Particularly dealing with counties, we are the service delivery partner for the state for a whole host of state-funded functions, including community corrections, many of the health and human services areas. And we really feel strongly that as essentially we're kind of like an agency of the state. But in our dealings with legislators, legislators don't often understand that. And we feel that the Governance Council could help facilitate better working of the counties and the legislature and the executive branch. We have on the handout before you rewritten some of the purpose statements, and I will say that some of these came from our good friends, the cities. Some of the ideas, quite frankly, have come from some research that we've been doing with other states and the types of governance councils that they have at other states. And we actually, I think in doing our research, the model that we liked the best was the state of Tennessee. They've had a governance council that has, I think it's called something different, but it's essentially that model. It's been functioning for the last 15 years. It's probably broader in scope than at least what we would initially envision. They have 15 staff members. We certainly don't envision that. Again, we envision this being staffed by AOC and LOC and special districts. It's just tremendous the things that that council achieves. They really work to provide quality government to the citizens of Tennessee. That's in their mission statement, and they do that really by working very strongly together. This is one of the many reports that they put out. This is a report on the study of E911 technology and funding, which is, of course, near and dear to our hearts here in Oregon as we're dealing with homeland security issues and emergency management. But there's just many, many, many things that that council has been able to do. Now, I don't envision Oregon getting there yet. But the other thing they did last legislative session is that they reviewed and made recommendation on 25 different bills that were going through the legislative process. And I certainly feel that our governance council, if we establish one, could be a body where we could make those kinds of recommendations. I'll just go back to my time in the legislature. We essentially had sort of a governance council briefly in time. It was very informal. But during the time that we dealt with Measure 47/50, On a daily basis, I was on in-house revenue that session, and on a daily basis, we had the special districts there, the cities there, the counties there. We could not, as well as Department of Revenue and Legislative Revenue, we could not have crafted House Bill or Measure 50 without the participation of all of our local government partners, speaking from the state legislature point of view. So, you know, I really think this governance council would be a valuable thing for Oregon to have, and very valuable in terms of our ability to foster a working relationship with the legislature and to deal with a lot of policy issues as well as funding issues. So we have changed the makeup of it slightly, and I guess the one thing I would like to say is that we would just like to tell you that we've come up with 13 members that you see listed here. But I think that we would like the opportunity to continue to tweak this, but we would move in the direction of being more inclusive rather than removing any of these memberships. But in researching what other states have done, we have also noticed that other states oftentimes have representatives from specific agencies, such as Department of Revenue, and since property tax issues, shared state revenues are a key issue for counties, cities, and special districts, that might be a thought. Department of Transportation is sometimes listed. Economic Development Department is sometimes listed. We haven't really had a chance to talk about those things, but I guess our thought would be that potentially this list might grow instead of just being the 13 members. So I would hand it off to whoever wants to go next.
Steve Bryant with League of Oregon Cities. Let me just echo some of those comments and add a little bit more. In the League's original correspondence to this committee, we also talked about the desire to improve the orientation process that takes place for new legislators. And that could happen within this governance council. I see later on your agenda you're talking about training for legislators, and I don't know whether you're planning on discussing it there. At some point, though, we still feel strongly there needs to be a design for a strengthened orientation process for not just new legislators, but returning legislators sometimes as well. Things change in the local government arena. Things change in terms of the partnership between state and local government. You saw a presentation from counties at the last meeting about all the interrelationships between county services and state services. I suspect that matrix changes from session to session as new services sort of change. So we feel we need to formalize a process where we can improve the dialogue and the education that takes place so that legislators are more familiar with those interrelationships and with the job that local government has to do to deliver services.
Chair Tim Chack, members of the committee, my name is Tracy Rutten, and I'm here today on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Just for some brief background information, SDO represents over 30 types of special districts across the state who play a critical role in providing services to communities both rural and urban. Currently, there are over 950 special districts across the state providing services to local communities. Each of those is governed independently by a locally elected board. As I'm sure that you're aware, we submitted a letter to this committee following its March meeting, voicing our concern with the proposal as it was discussed at that time. I've also distributed written testimony today to the committee, but I'll be brief and try and respect your time today and just say that I believe that the concerns that we voiced in that letter have been addressed, and we're pleased with the proposal as it is written. Our biggest concern is that if there is going to be discussion about local governments and potential discussions that might impact the delivery of services across the state of Oregon, that all local governments be involved in that process. I also have Greg Baker, the executive director of SDA, with me today, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
I think those who were at the last meeting will recall that there was some, I don't know, know if the skepticism on behalf of the committee members as to the need for this, and perhaps that this was a matter of the League of Oregon Cities and Association of Oregon Counties, that they were, it was their job to lobby, and the legislators' job to listen and to reach sound decisions based on their conversations. And I know Mr. Herring and others were questioning the need to create another separate bureaucracy to have this next year. Mr. Herring, is that similar? Any fair there? And
I think it's a fair summary of my views on the thing. Nobody doubts the need for the usefulness of consultation and the cooperation and being informed and informing each other and meeting and all that. Well, I guess some people would tell me about the usefulness of meetings. But it seems to me that part of my job here is to recommend, make recommendations that would improve the governance of Oregon. The legislative process. And I think one of the bedrock principles we operate on is that all local governments are creatures of the state. I'm worried that by setting up some sort of a consultative process in which the commission is created, the representatives are sent to the commission, there will be different levels of government that are not at all equal. That we put on money the borders in Oregon about how the state ought to be governed and how American government in fact works, what it's supposed to work. Say, the counties may not, especially districts, everything in my ear about it, but they're not the state government. They got nothing to say about the state government in the sense of the state making public policy. As you point out, the counties often have to do the work that the state imposes on them. But that, I guess, is the way the system works. And if the counties can't do the work, they don't like the way it's being imposed on them. I think there's plenty of channels available for making that known to those making the policy. One of the difficulties in Oregon is that people don't know how the state is governed. They must be running this constantly for people. Don't know where to turn. They see something done, they think it's the wrong thing. And they don't know that it's a special district and not the city, or that it's the county and not the city, or the city and not the county, and all that stuff. And it seems to me that even if you can keep Oregon government in its structure, the better off we are in the long run. And as far as it's up to the people working within that structure to try to get along as best they can, without adding additional formal structures that have to be funded, authorized, and so on. I'm reminded by one more point, and that is that earlier in this process, we had a rundown of governance committees or councils or commissions that have been formed in a number of other states. And if I'm not completely mistaken about what I remember there about that rundown, is that in most of those places, commissions have been set up and have fallen into disuse because of a number of reasons. But in fact, I mean, the structure existed, but they were not used to appoint this thing. And so, no, I grant all your points. That is, it is useful to get along and to the legislature, certainly, and the governor to know what the counties are up against and so on. I think there ought to be a better way to get this set up in the separate commission to handle that problem.
Mr. Sheehan,
I guess my question would be, is this the only model? I know we've had to put before us another possibility of recommending committees from set up by the legislature. There is indeed a recognition among legislators that they don't have enough information about the implications of decisions on other government bodies. What is your perspective?
Well, thank you for asking that question.
Commissioner Lewis, is that in the past there was a House and Senate Committee on Intergovernmental Affairs, mm-hmm. no longer, and the committee members discussed among themselves, and Representative Boone, the possibility of recommending that the House and Senate create and go back to a committee under criminal affairs?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Schutte. That certainly would be at least a starting point. But frankly, Commissioner Herring refers to the fact that many of these governance councils are no longer in use around the country. I think there's still about half a dozen that are in the research that we did. But one of the things we found is that one of the reasons why some of these governance entities tended to fail was that they were brought into the legislature as a committee, and that pretty much that was the end of them. And the successful ones in the research that we did, the successful ones were independent bodies. So had to have some autonomy from the legislature and the governor's office, although clearly, you know, they have legislative members on them. They have members from the executive branch. So they're, you know, they've got, you know, those connections, but they did function, you know, independently. So that's what some of our research has told us. Definitely, if the legislature wants to form another committee on governmental affairs, that would definitely be a starting point. It would be better than where we are today. And I guess I would just, you know, respectfully have to disagree with some of the things that Commissioner Herring has said, simply because I've now been on both sides of the aisle. I was a legislator for three terms in the 90s, and even though I thought I knew about local government when I went to the legislature, I mean, I owned a business, so I dealt regularly with the city government in the county, in Yamhill County. I was on my county's planning commission for 10 years at the county level. I'd obviously dealt with my, you know, county, some of my county departments just as a resident. I thought I knew about local government when I went to the legislature, but I guess having now become a county commissioner, I am shocked at how little, even during the 6 years I was a legislator, I am shocked at how little I really knew about county government. And I think I did a pretty darn good job as a legislator, but I lacked a lot of knowledge about how local governments function. And I will tell you the learning curve, I really concur with what Steve Bryant said about the orientation process for legislators, because the learning curve for a new legislator coming in is just huge. And there really isn't any education about local governments as part of that orientation process. Most of the orientation is how to be in a committee, how to manage things on the floor, you know, the Mason's rules that you're operating under. That's what most of the orientation is about. How do you get along with your fellow legislators? It's not really about how you or any kind of orientation having to do with your knowledge about local government. I understand what you, Commissioner Herring, what you said about the complexity for the citizen. It is very complicated to understand that, okay, if I have something to do with fire, I go to my fire district. If I have something to do with parks, I go to the Parks and Recs district. If I have, you know, oh, there's a pothole in that road. Well, is that a city street, a county road, a state highway? You know, the average citizen doesn't know the answers to those questions, and they feel like they get the runaround when they go to these different levels of government. I actually think the council, and I think that's the model that Tennessee has been so successful at, the council can function as a way to facilitate the communication of those different levels of government and to work towards making a more seamless government to the public. So that what we're all here for is to serve the same constituencies. We don't have different constituents. They're all the same people. And our goal should be to no matter what level government is to try to work to better serve the public. And I think the council could do that. But again, if your view is that going towards a committee as a starting point, that would be better than doing nothing, because frankly, I think now we have a void at the state level in terms of understanding by legislators. I would say of the 90 of them, their understanding is all over the map as to how much they understand about local government.
Representative Fenneman?
Well, I have have my own, I went the other way. I started with the county commission and learned that inside out, and then came to the state. And so I had a little bit of understanding of local government, if you will, and also with a local fire service, although our volunteer department is not, we only deal usually with our own constituents there, and then with, of course, cities as we develop a mutual aid agreement with them in some cases. And then we also dealt with state agencies, you know, the forestry department and roads and everything like that. So I maybe don't fit the mold as the person coming in totally clueless. And then it changes too. And so I just depend on the AOC and the LOC and then my own county commissioners and city councilors and, you know, local government representatives to keep me apprised of what they want me to know, what's happening with them. And, you know, in our area, it doesn't seem to be a problem. I've probably met with people from Clatsop and Tillamook more often than Columbia and Washington, but that was starting to change too. So I think it's incumbent on a long way to get around to what Mr. Herring was saying. I think it's incumbent on each of the state legislators to get a good understanding of what locally they need to for their own district, but then, you know, applying it to the statewide and other districts too, with the local representatives and or the representatives from the various agencies, but associations that represent commissioners and city councils. And I think that that's just part of being a legislator. Is you end up, you know, there's more steps than you're ever going to know, but it is constant that you just have to keep, you have to keep those lines of information open. And if you don't, then you're going to end up in a situation like Commissioner Lewis was talking about. And I don't know about the rest of my colleagues, but I get a lot of information either by email, telephone, and often letters too, from various local government agencies and representatives, just FYIs, things like that they think I should be aware of.
Well, Representative Boone, with all due respect, I mean, I kept the lines of communications open as well. I talked to my county commissioners on a weekly basis. That isn't really what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about the fact that the legislature can cut $30 million out of community corrections funding to the counties and then expect the same level of parole and probation functions at the county level, even with the $30 million gone. I mean, it's that kind of disconnect. And I did this many times, and you know, maybe you had a better insight than I did, but every session there's a parade of bills that different organizations come in and want exemptions from the property tax rolls. I always voted for them because, you know, you think, gosh, this is a nice thing to do. You're giving a little, you know, this little nonprofit wants an exemption from the property tax rolls. This is a nice thing to do. It isn't, you know, now sitting on the other side of the aisle, I realize it's not my revenue. It's the local government revenue I was giving away. Perhaps you vote no on all of those, but a whole lot of legislators are not even really aware that property tax revenue is not their revenue. It's the city and county and special district revenue that they're giving away just to be nice to some constituent. It's those kinds of...
And I, that's kind of what I meant, is that having originally set up a good relationship with local government, it's an easy call to make and say, you know, hey, we've got this bill, this is what it does, what do you think? Mm-hmm. And hopefully they get back.
Well, I'd like to clone you with the other 89 people.
That would be right. Mr.
Chair, I had just great hesitation to set up any new council. Well, but I with the the hope that it would be effective. I share the concern that I think this is expressed by Commissioner Herring about representatives on such a council from such a diversity of bodies and how we could expect that there would be digital traction on the key issues that you want addressed. But I guess my biggest concern is that if the goal is really to increase the knowledge of many legislators, is this the right strategy? Mandatory orientation comes to mind. There's maybe a better strategy, but from what you have said and also what Representative Boone has said, it sounds to me like it's an orientation at the local level, at the level where you can really understand the impacts of the state on local governmental bodies. And so I'm not sure that the council is really the way to get that kind of understanding of the impacts.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Schutte. I understand where you're coming from on that, and certainly part of it is the orientation that we talked about, but part of it is the ongoing ability to have some input as bills are moving through the legislature. For example, one of the things that was passed when I was in the legislature was Measure 30, which had to do with unfunded mandates. It was a referral that we sent out to the voters passed it, and so now every piece of legislation has to have a Measure 30 impact statement to indicate whether or not it's an unfunded mandate to local government. Well, you know, that's a good thing, but I mean, I think we need to take it a step farther than that, and that's one of the things this council function, this council could do, is the council could bills that had to do with local governments could go to the council, and we could have an impact, you know, a report from the council saying what the impact would be to local government. I personally think that would be a good thing for legislators to look at as they're looking at revenue impact, fiscal impact, Measure 30 impact, and they could also have a report from the council on, you know, the local government impact. I guess it's all well and good to say just talk to your county commissioners more, talk to your city councils more. When you're a legislator and you are going at, particularly as it gets towards the end of, you know, the last 3 or 4 months of session, and you're going at 90 miles an hour from, you know, 7 a.m. in the morning till 10 o'clock at night, there's just a lot of both policy and budget that do not get the proper input from the local government that I feel would be valuable, and that's one of the functions that I think this council could perform. And believe me, I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I am not in favor of more bureaucracy. I mean, Chair Timchuk will tell you that. I'm definitely not.
I think what you're after is something that has more weight than what we already get. These impact statements are being prepared already. That's the essence of being cities, counties, everybody keeps sending everybody these newsletters for annual reports of impact. And each one of the school boards association, they all discuss all the bills that could potentially affect them. And anybody who looks at that stuff is not sure information about how this is going to affect anybody. I think what you're after is something that's a little more formal, that has more weight, that has more weight to this legislative process. And that, I think, is where you run into a real problem, that it's not that more beyond what we're talking about here, that it's really a constitutional question. That is, the Constitution provides for the way the state government ought to operate. It has the executive branch, the legislative branch, the judicial branch, doesn't have yet another branch that's some sort of a consultative outfit that's supposed to prevent everything that the legislation does that might affect somebody else. That's what it just isn't such a thing. And when you add some kind of a legislative informator to that kind of commission, I think you may step across that line that says this is really not the way the government ought to be organized.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of Commissioner Linda, he made the comment about, I was talking about the league and AOC playing a lobbyist role, and he sort of challenged us, you know, you shouldn't be lobbyists. I'm not quite sure where he was going with that, but I think the point is an interesting one, in that we're really in the same business. We're all levels of government are interested in public safety, we're interested in affordable housing, we're interested in economic development, we're interested in improving the state's infrastructure. So we have these common objectives, but I don't think anybody can look at the system that we have and argue that it's the most efficient system for providing those services. And I think we recognize that, that there have to be ways to improve our efficiency as collective units of government. And if we sort of hold that out as the end game here, we ought to find some ways to recommend improvements in our process designed at making government more efficient. And I think a key step in that is communication, improved communication between the different levels of government. That takes us out of sort of the heavy focus on advocacy and lobbying that we currently spend a lot of resources at, and more into the arena of partnership. So this may not be the perfect mechanism for doing that, but I'm convinced that there's something better out there than our current system, and it begins with some sort of dialogue, and it's probably some sort of forced dialogue. We do it in a lot of voluntary ways now. I serve on a group called the Community Development Forum, which is made up of cities, counties, special districts, state agencies, the governor's office. It works very well in terms of providing a forum for people to talk to each other, and we have a much better understanding of what our needs are. We make recommendations to the state agencies about their budget proposals and policies. And we sort of force each other to the table to talk about issues that's going to affect each other. And that model, I think, works reasonably well. This is taking that just to a higher level. How do we get our units of government into a forced conversation about making service delivery more efficient, more effective? You know, you take the area of public safety. There is a tremendous amount of duplication of service and of turf battles that we fight, which for the common taxpayer probably doesn't make a lot of sense. They just want somebody out there on the highway to do traffic enforcement. But we spend time arguing about who ought to be providing that traffic enforcement, who ought to be providing the jail space, who ought to be providing drug enforcement in our state. And if we had more dialogue together, I think we could have some chance of improving the efficiency and the operations of government.
Some governors appointed by the governor with consent from the state senate with the front of it. It would never trouble us to who does the drug enforcement. The one guy does. Highway, same thing, everything. I mean, the efficiency, if that's what you want, then you can get it. But probably beyond our store here.
I hope so.
It is, of course, the issue that is closest and dearest to the heart of Commission Co-Chair Pryor, who cannot be with us today, and so I, in prior discussion, told her that we wouldn't put any final action until she could be here. So I think we'll probably push this over to the next meeting, but I think you can sense from the committee remaining skeptical of the need for a governance council. If in the meantime you want to provide Administrator Taylor with any more information on the Tennessee proposal or anything like that, that might be helpful. But I would anticipate, if I'm counting noses correctly, or a betting man, since I'm chairman of the Water Commission, I am a betting man, that we may be going towards the direction of a recommendation at the least to the Intergovernmental Affairs Committee once again in the House and Senate, because probably as far as this division is going to go.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that would at least be a good starting point, and then maybe folks would, you know, maybe that would be all that we need in Oregon. Maybe folks, after a time of having those intergovernmental affairs committees going, would see that, hey, you know, a council like this could really work and function. So I don't necessarily object to that, but I think a strong statement by this subcommittee that there is a need to foster more intergovernmental communications and a better working relationship between all the different levels of government. It's really for the benefit of the citizens of Oregon, not for any of us specifically. Again, we're all trying to serve the same people and do it in the best way possible. Okay.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Representative Boone.
You're welcome.
There you go.
Thank you.
I think we'll move now to the, we've also placed the alcohol and capital issue again on the agenda, and Steve Dolan and Pat are with us again today, as they have been in the past. Steve and Nan, do you want to come up? As you know, we have talked about this at two prior meetings, and one prior meeting. It's important, so we've talked about this in the past. The role of Nick Pratt did provide us with a recommendation about policy involving I'm going to summarize it there.
Ian Pratt and Steve Gold provided us with a recommendation at the last committee meeting, which was basically allow somebody who sees an intoxicated member to report that person to the Secretary of Senate or Chief Secretary, and then some sanctions would be applied to the member. And if those sanctions, there depending on how often or how many times that person has been intoxicated. And I think that the focus of the proposal is that, well, I'm sure Ian and Steve have said that they wanted to focus on members and staff not being intoxicated during work.
Is that a fair summary?
It is a fair summary. Sure.
Go
ahead. Well, I want to address, Mr. Chair and members of the commission. Commissioner Herring brought up an issue in the last meeting that I think was a very valid issue, and I think we might have found an answer to it, and that is the issue of a malicious or frivolous claim, and that's how that may affect a legislator in a election or in their career as a legislator. Now, is that a fair? There is a within the Senate actually has a special committee on conduct already set up. Unfortunately, the House does not, and so a lot of this could go to that special committee in the Senate when it would be a senator. And I think that there is a mechanism to set up the same type of a committee within the House. But within that committee and within those rules, there is a sub chapter here that addresses the issue of frivolous or malicious claims. And if someone if it is determined that a complainant of improper conduct is frivolous or malicious, the person filing the complaint is subject to appropriate disciplinary action, including the sections set forth in a Rule 18.09, which includes reprimand, censure, or expulsion. So there is so that if a complaint is frivolous or malicious and the complaint is not grounded in fact or warranted, and brought forward solely to harass the accused person or interfere with the work of the senator or that person, then they can be have action brought against them. So I just wanted to bring that up.
Does that refer to senators who make accusations, or does it refer to somebody, a citizen who comes to the hall and says, "Blood, that's not food"?
No. I'm sorry. Chair Tim Chuck and Commissioner Herring, it says a person. Now, I would guess that I haven't read thoroughly through this, but it doesn't say a senator. It says a person.
Well, it seems to me that it wouldn't be much of a term. It would be if you're down from the railroad station coming through here and said, "That's a senator, I spell you."
I hear you.
Yeah, other thing I'm not worried about is whether what one food would be brought to bear when somebody makes an application. But that players be subject to important paper tests or something, or get a sample.
Well, I'm not sure that I do. I never have claimed to have all the answers to anything. But we did bring up this analogy last time of the sexual harassment issue, and I think it has some validity here, because in the case of sexual harassment, it's a much more hidden issue generally than this alcohol issue is. I think that the issue still is to put something in place and to raise the specter of this, just like sexual harassment had the specter raised back in the early to mid 80s. Maybe it was before that, it should have been, but I think that's when it really the issue came to the forefront or came to the surface. And I think by doing this, and then by having this in the orientations when people come to the legislature and have it reviewed with the members who have been around for a while, maybe at the beginning of every legislature, I think it'll put everybody on notice that, in fact, that this has been recognized, that there's been a situation that's been ongoing in the past, it's been ongoing for years. Again, I think I said last time that I don't come to this very easily because on one hand, I'm embarrassed that I didn't come forward before. On the other hand, I know all the sensitivities around this. But I'm not going to name names, but I think we mentioned this before. I know of a senator that I visited. It doesn't just happen on sine die. I know of a senator I visited several times during the course of a session who was visibly intoxicated in the middle of the day in his office. And I went to the president of the Senate at that time and the majority leader, and nothing was done. And, I recognize the sensitivities not only around the politics, but let's face it, I'm guessing everybody in this room has had a drink at one time or another. I mean, maybe there's some that hasn't. I'm certainly not a teetotaler, as I've said before, and I like a good cold beer in the summertime, and I like a nice glass of wine with dinner. But it cuts close to home. There's no doubt about it, and it's a sensitive issue from a lot of standpoints. But it's something that I really feel needs to be addressed because I'll tell you what I'd like to do if the chair would indulge me. I'd like to read a letter. This is if you could bear with me. This actually was sent to the editor of the Eugene Register Guard. Thank you. I'm really having a hard time here today. And it was sent to me. I don't know if it was printed or not, but the issue is this is coming from just somebody in the public. And I'm going to have to read the whole thing to put it in context for you, but I want you to particularly listen to the last paragraph. It says, "The shriek coming from the lobby defending criminals from the cold truth told by citizen lobbyists Ann and Bruce Pratt reflects how close to home they struck. I find it extremely odd that Arwin Byrd, a member of the Western Prison Project, who on record opposed victims' rights in Oregon, claims to be sympathetic with victims. Another fact is that Representative Shields and Greenlick voted against several pieces of anti-DUI legislation this past session, Shields twice being the lone no vote on the House floor and Greenlick voting against a DUI bill that would have provided much-needed revenue to state police. Noted as well was that not once did these defenders of criminal rights deny that legislators and staff were hitting the bottle inappropriately during the end of the legislative session. Oregon Administrative Rules 125.75.015 regulates and prohibits possession of alcoholic beverages and illegal substances by state employees and the public on the premises of most state office buildings and grounds around the Capitol. Yet we have no rules or state statutes to prohibit legislators from drinking on the job or possessing illegal drugs in the state Capitol building itself. We routinely screen for drugs and alcohol in most all jobs, including other state employees, pilots, school bus drivers, and corporate employees. At my job, I would be fired so fast my head would spin if I were caught drinking. Why are our leaders exempt? Is it too much to ask that legislators be at least sober on the judge? Now, that's from a citizen of the state of Oregon. I might also want to add for the record, neither Mr. or Representative Greenlick nor Shields were representatives in question as far as drinking goes at the end of the session or at any other time to my knowledge. But this gets down really to the ground on this thing, especially that last paragraph. And this is why I think it's important that we act on this. And I'll...
Mr. Henderson, if I can borrow you for a minute, I need to stop. Dave Henderson, who is the legislative administrator. Some other ideas that committee members have discussed among themselves in order to recommend the Speaker and the House President of the Senate establish a committee, some sort of ad hoc committee to review alcohol policies and issues, or a recommendation of the legislative administration committee to review building policies related to alcohol consumption and storage and enforcement. Any thoughts, comments, suggestions on directions on those?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Henderson, the Legislative Administrator. It is the Legislative Administration Committee that is responsible for the management of the building itself, so that might be an appropriate venue. Another area, obviously, where it could be addressed would be in House and Senate rules, which would fall under the purview of the leaders and the Chief Clerk and the Secretary of the Senate, so that would be another alternative that could be used.
And as I recall, the correct policy and the current policy is that while other state buildings, alcohol is not allowed in there, and the Capitol is not included in that list. And obviously, there are exceptions and events here in the evenings.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. But I wouldn't want anyone to have the impression that there are frequently receptions where alcohol is served. I did a count before one of your last meetings, and the number of meetings at which alcohol is served is a very small number. And it's only allowed after 5 o'clock. And I believe we limit it to 90 minutes, and it must stop. We must stop serving alcohol at least 30 minutes prior to the end of the event. So we're very, very strict and very limited in what alcohol is allowed to be served, and it can only be served by licensed servers, obviously.
Thank you, Marion.
I think we ought to find a way to do what
the
Republican asked, in the sense that we want to put this before us on notice that drunkenness on the job is not. Can we make a recommendation to that fact and suggest that the rules reflect something along that line?
And Mr. Taylor, I might suggest that a proposal be written up whereas, I say something like, whereas the committee heard testimony about incidents of drinking on the job, you know, we'd like to make a recommendation. We regard this as a serious issue, a serious violation, and recommend that the leadership and the administration committee, you know, some of that doctor.
I think it would be all right. I think it would make sense, in fact, for the Senate and the House to have rules that say it is unacceptable for any member of this body to be drunken in any physical capacity unless he's at home or something. That's all. And then, not worry at the moment exactly how this is going to be enforced. I would think that if that is something in the rules, and somebody has the tendency to take too much at lunch or in the afternoon, and somebody would call to that person's attention. So that would be enough. I don't know. The rule says that's what you're supposed to do. And if you don't do that, you'll have to do something.
So, Mr. Chairman, the committee.
Can I ask a question at this point, or should I wait till after the motion?
No, go ahead.
I just wondered how, it was really, really hard to hear you, Steve, but I tried, and hopefully I didn't miss the next, you know, the answer to my asking questions. But how, other than Tiny Guy, how often has this been perceived as being a problem?
Commissioner Representative Boone, sorry, I neglected to move the. I was speaking in the microphone, but I forgot you're on the phone here, obviously, because I can't see you. Yeah, I'm sorry. To be honest with you, I've only witnessed it twice in my 10 years here, or whatever, 10 to 12 years. So, I mean, outside of Sine Die, generally when I see it is around Sine Die. And when I say witness it.
I've worked there 18 years now, and that seems to be the time that if you're going to see it, you'll see it. But, and I think that there's, and with all due respect, and I appreciate both yours and Anne's comments and recommendations and everything, but it seems like it's pretty isolated, and I'm not trying to make an excuse for it, because occasionally people will meet in there, especially during the end when you don't leave the building because we're going so long. Around dinner time, people will have a glass of wine in their office or something like that. And I would hate to see, you know, the fact that if you wanted to do that, you'd have to leave the building and all that, because if you stay during working hours, that is be interesting to get everybody's take on what exactly are working hours when you're in the legislature, because it seems like it's constant. So anyway, I just wanted to know, and that's kind of my take on it too, that it was mostly around the Tiny Guy for the last couple of days.
Well, if I may, I'm sorry. If I may, just to clarify, when I say I've only witnessed it twice, I've only witnessed it with two other individuals, but it was on multiple occasions. I want to be clear on that. My only reaction to that, Commissioner Representative Boone, is that I think working hours are working hours. I mean, I think it's pretty easily defined what working hours are. And I, you know, as just as a general response to Mr. Henderson, I'm not saying that he was even inferring this, but I want to go back because there was a misunderstanding when we first came to this panel about we're not trying to prohibit alcohol from the building. That's not the point. So I don't want anybody to think that we're in any way going back to that.
Well, I understand that. And my motion, that it is a motion, was to be effective, not to worry about. Incorporated in the rules, a rule that says that it's unacceptable for members to be intoxicated during their legislative work.
An answer to Representative Boone's question, I have seen it at other times. I'm going to say a couple other times other than Sine Die. I've only participated in one Sine Die. I viewed it one time at a press conference that was held at 8:30 or 9 in the morning. And that was in the 2003 session, and I talked about that senator at the last meeting. Reporters. I just wanted to comment that on our proposal that we made, I know that you were going to issue our proposal to the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate and get feedback from them. And I did get a little bit of feedback, and some of it was, it's too strict. Some of them had no problem with it. And I just want to say again, it is they are suggestions, and it's our proposal, and it's a starting place, and it could be rearranged. And so it's just, we would like to see the problem handled within the chambers.
Mr. Harry, your motion would be to recommend the House and Senate rules, either dollar, the House and Senate leaders develop rules prohibit members and staff from being intoxicated while performing official legislative duties.
That is correct.
Motion has been moved and seconded. Any further discussion there among committee members? Mr. Tewes, we have a vote. Roll call.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Harry?
Yes.
Pryor, excused.
Yes.
Yoshida, excused.
Aye. So that will be a recommendation from this committee at this time.
And thank you. And it's hard to do this because I don't believe, but thanks for both Steve and Hannah, who are still up there. Thank you for clarifying that for me. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Representative Boone.
Thank you for your time.
Yeah, Chair Tim Chuck and committee members, thank you very much for commissioners, I should say. I'm sorry. I get used to the legislative thing. Thanks very much for your indulgence. Bye.
Okay, we're going to take a brief pause here again. I'm not sure whether we're having audio. She would appreciate a report on how the activism relates to diversity issues and diversity on the last lecture. So we promised Mr. Richard Thompson and Gordon that he would get back to us on that, and he is here to do so.
Chair Tim Chuck, members of the committee, again, Dave Henderson, Legislative Administrator. We do not have records on diversity of the employees of the Legislative Assembly. They are hired individually by the 90 legislators themselves, and there is no requirement that these employees self-disclose any protected classes that, of which they may be a member. So we don't have diversity statistics on the Assembly. I can tell you that for legislative administration, which is the largest of the four support offices for the Assembly, we have diversity statistics for our agency. Our stated goal of the agency is to reflect the diversity of the population of the state. Unfortunately, we're not there right now. We're underrepresented among Hispanics, and we're slightly underrepresented among African Americans. But it is a clearly stated objective of all of our recruitments to look to increasing the diversity among our staff. So while we're not where we would like to be, it is an objective of ours, and it's one that we take very seriously and pursue on a regular basis. Chair Tinchuk, many legislative branch employees fill out an employment application form. All of our employees do. There's a self-disclosure area there where you check a box if you're a member of any of whatever ethnic diversity you may be. Many of the Legislative Assembly employees don't fill out that form. So we are working with legislative leadership to perhaps require that in the future, so we might be better able to report on those numbers in the future.
Thank you. I think committee members in discussion in the past, and correct me if I'm wrong, we're not of the inclination that to ban the process of nepotism and hiring and relatives, given the nature of the legislature, the fact that people come from far away, from much of the year, they bring their spouses often know the legislature, know the district, as well as the legislators. Was the case with the legislator I work for, Bill Markham, who was part of my group in Virginia every session. Virginia legislature, everybody as well as Bill did. I didn't sense a consensus in recommending a banning of the process of hiring legislators hiring family members as staff. Although I did sense a concern with the issue of salary adjustments of those staff members, as was seen in the last session with Representative Divorce difficulties. And we discussed perhaps a recommendation that any salaries of legislative
of staff who are relatives of the legislators who hire him be reviewed, and any adjustments to the salary have to be approved by legislative leadership. Is that something, an issue that still makes sense to committee members?
I think so, and I think we ought to recommend exactly that. That is number two on our list, that is to allow legislators to hire family members, but review wage increases or wage increases that have to be approved by the presiding officer or some other entity. Some other entity, well, the presiding officer.
Presiding officer.
I am concerned that this would only be wage increases, and the initial wage at which a family member might be hired might be terribly high.
I agree. It should just be the wages. And I know that this is also an issue that's being reviewed by the Oregon Law Commission. It's also reviewing, and perhaps the Governmental Senate Practice Commission looking at this issue. I mean, Representative's worst problems obviously raised many red flags to other ethics commissions and agencies, so they may be reviewing this as well. But I would move that the committee makes a recommendation and moves to the full commission that we continue to allow the process of legislators hiring family members. However, the wage levels set for those family members and any increases to those levels would be approved by the presiding officer of the legislative body. Commissioner, Mr. Henderson, do you see any problem, I mean, technical problems, administrative problems with how that would be administrated? And please come forward. Promoted Kennedy, clerk of the House, is here with us today, so we're glad to have him. Commissioner Henderson, or Mr. Henderson. Dave.
Sorry. Chair Timchuk, the only thing that strikes me is that there would obviously have to be self-disclosure of the nature of the family relationship.
Correct.
Because clearly you can have a situation where they wouldn't have
same last name,
so we might not know that Sally Smith is the daughter of Senator John Smith.
Right.
For whatever reason.
Okay, I may amend my motion here in a minute with that. Ramona, did you have any?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ramona Kennedy. I'm Chief Clerk of the House. And I had a conversation with leadership on the House side after the situation that faced us a few months ago, and came up with a recommendation which I think they embraced, which would be different than what you just suggested, in that each member on the House side is allocated a certain amount of dollars to operate their office, and that is dollars different.
Can I do the same as the Senate side as well?
Correct. Okay. And within those dollars is two salaries set. In the interim, one salary set for a part-time person. And then in the session, also a $15.50 a day allocation for services, supplies, meaning, maybe getting some copying from archives or for Secretary of State or whatever. It's a limited allocation that they get. And instead of putting leadership in a position of authorizing any salary statements or increases within a person's office, we have adopted through what's called the House Management Handbook, where that the members can't spend outside that budget allocation. And whatever the interim would be, that budget allocation, they can't overspend. During the interim, I also suggested that it be prorated, i.e., if a member is going to resign from the legislature, they don't have access to the whole pot of money that's given to them in the interim. They're only allocated the amount of money, then prorated, let's say, for example, on an 18-month basis.
Is that different than the current rules?
Current rules gives them the total allocation up front, and we have had problems in the past where when somebody is departing from the legislature, they believe that's their entire pot of the money. And I think that's where we found our some problems with the increase in salaries as they depart the legislature. And that then takes the leadership out of the position of micromanaging or managing other members, particularly from the other side of the aisle. And had that been in place when former Representative Worth had resigned, she would have not been able to then propose a increased salary for a family member or for any other member of her staff, because she wouldn't have had those dollars available to her.
But legislators could still hire, I know they're allocated money that usually hires two. They could still hire just one and pay their spouse, son, daughter, the entire amount.
There are some members who believe, and the salaries are not, you know, extremely high, okay? So, and if they feel that they can meet their needs, then they usually set that salary, but they're not going to be able to triple it as they're leaving office. Otherwise, they're not going to have any money left to do anything else. And we do cut off their resources for supplies or postage or anything else should they supersede the allocation that they have. And they and we can actually take their expense check if, in fact, we miss it by 1 month and hold that for repayment. And so it really does put a cap on each member to be responsible. It makes sure that is, and all the situations we've had where that they've kind of gone off the reservation and as you mind is when they're departing from the legislature. Typically, the members are very well managing their budget because they know it has to last for the full 18 months or during session the full 6-7 months. And it's not a large amount.
Does the clerk's office or the Secretary of Senate's office, to your knowledge, provide a recommended range salary level?
It is in the budget, and that's why I'm saying it is what's ever budgeted by Ways and Means from the previous session, because it comes into that next session, and it's set in House rule.
I mean, for a particular position. Recommended range for the legislative assistant's job is this. A recommended range for the secretary's
job.
We
do recommend that. Okay, but we do have members, again, I don't want to give you the false perception, a few members have decided to co-mingle those funds for the secretary and the LA and pay somebody maybe $3,000 a month, but they've been in the legislative process for a really long time. I use as an example, before Representative Boone became a legislator, she was a legislative assistant to Representative Hobson. And before that, Representative Josie. She was paid to do the entire job at about $3,000 a month.
But she was not a family member.
I understand. And it's not always a family member,
right.
Okay, that makes those kind of money.
Well, we'll call another community here, I think it's also would be helpful for the legislators if they were able to say somebody else has approved the salary of my husband, wife, son, daughter, because it would allow them, if anyone makes an issue with it, it would allow them to say, well, I wasn't the one who... But anyway, other thoughts from committee members? Representative Boone, feel free to jump in here, too. So.
Well, I appreciate Ramona's comments, because it's true. Sometimes some legislators have 3 or 4 people in their office, and granted, they don't get paid very much, and maybe 1 or 2 of them may be a non-paid intern, with one of the programs that U of O, Oregon State, Willamette, or Western gives kids a chance or students a chance to have that position during session. But the other piece of it that she said that's really important is, you know, you're allotted this pot of money, if you will, and it has to last through session and interim. And it's incumbent on you to make sure that that does so that you can do the work that you need to do. And so and what she said is true, is if you can't overspend it, but if it's on track to, see, we're given a statement every month of what your expenses are, what they've been, and what is proposed to be the balance at the end at this rate, you know, for the salaries. And they're divided out between expenses and, for example, postage and supplies and things and salary. But you know, if you're paying your person $3,000 a month and you've got 12 months left, that better add up. And if it doesn't, you need to make a salary adjustment. And that goes through personnel. And you know, so there's no way it can be a surprise to anybody. You know how much you're going to have. You know how well you're using it. And it's your job to budget it accordingly. And if you know, for example, you're during the interim, obviously the money goes way down. What happened with me is during interim, my pay was cut in half. if I stayed on. I didn't always work for the representative during the interim, but, you know, you have to find somebody who's willing to do that, too. Have it take a decent salary during session and then have it cut in half for the next 18 months.
Again, but we're not talking about employees who aren't relatives of legislators.
Right, but it's the same thing. Because if you had your spouse or your right. child working for you, you could pay them, you know, more during session when there's
more work to do.
More work to do. You know, in that sense, but actually that might be arguably not true either. But in interim's pretty busy. But you need to, or they would need to know, or you'd need to have, you know, an agreement. Say, okay, but during interim, you're only going to get paid this much because this money has to stretch twice as long. So, and they don't give the same, Ramona, you know what it is. It's, and it's agreed upon by the budget committee. It changes from session to session.
Mr. Herring.
Was kind of do I understand from what you said that in the system that you now have, the allocation is by the month so that it really can't be overdrawn?
No, there's a, if I'm understanding you correctly, Hasso, it's there's X number of dollars total, and there's supposedly 6 months in the session, and you divide that into 6 months, and then there's a range, like Ramona suggested. They suggest you pay a legislative assistant X number of dollars, and a secretary X number of dollars, to that will last you the entire time. Then there's the interim period, which is supposedly 18 months, or you know when it's longer or shorter, but then that money that's left in that account has to last that amount of time. So if you have a part, because there's really only enough to pay a part-time person at that point, and that is divided into, we'll just say 18 months. And so if you're paying $3,000 a month for a session, and you go into interim, you don't have that kind of money per month if you figure it out by the month. Or else I suppose you could, and I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, Ramona, that if you were going set to run out of money, say, in October, you would just lay that person off.
Mark Kennedy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Boone, Commissioner Herring. Yes, it is a, if you run out of revenues, you know, monies, then we, and I track that monthly on behalf of the Speaker of the House, and the Speaker's office also tracks that. We notify both the caucus offices and the members that they are budgeting in a way that they're going to run out of money and that they will have to lay the people off. It is not a monthly allocation. It is a some amount. However, we do projections on that money. The reason why it's a some amount allocated, particularly during session, is as a new member, you may want to get, we only provide one computer, and the computers right now are 4 years old or older, and so they may take that money, a large amount of that money, and buy a new computer because they have two staff in their office, or they may need one that is tagged as state property. But back to your original concern on family members. Again, because I believe that the members typically, and only on a rare occasion, and I believe we could put some rules in place that would even put that in check, that the members manage their monies well, to put leadership, the speaker, in a position of having to authorize salary increases no matter what the staff person is, whether it's a family member or not, really puts them particularly at odds with that member should they decide that, you know, a salary increase, even if it's one step, would have to go through the speaker. And again, when this happened with Representative Worth, the Senate made a decision to put it in their rules that leadership would review it. In chatting with my leadership, they did not want to be put in that position, and so I came up with language for a rule change that made it impossible for them to give that size of increase, but did not put leadership in the position of having to all of a sudden manage some of their resources that are allocated to everybody.
I think that makes a lot of sense in this business about leadership being in control of somebody to be opposing party pay. It's a good point, and I hadn't considered that.
I think all we're trying to prevent, we've already disposed of the idea of hiring relatives. We think that's all right because of Oregon's particular situation. All we're trying to prevent is a recurrence of the Worth fiasco. And so that's why, but if you have a system already that prevents that, then I think all I think we should do is say stick with the system.
But it doesn't prevent a legislator from hiring a family member, paying the full wage, and having them take off for pay-go for 6 months. I mean, that's another thing.
Well, as soon as the local weekly finds that out, I would take care of that.
Yeah.
Chairman Tim Chuck, we do have, again, it's not adopted yet, but the recommendation is they couldn't pay their family member the full wage and go to pay-go. Okay? That's what happened, and the recommendation I'm making to leadership for adoption into their rules next session, we prohibit that.
By
rule, in that they would be prorated. So if they only serve for 1 month, let's say you get, you know, $20,000, and you have to allocate that for, as it is allocated budget-wise, for 180-day session, however many months that is, then they would only have access to that first 30 days of those dollars. Therefore, they couldn't pay the full price.
That's what I was asking, the monthly allocation.
It is allocated at the get-go, but they would not be able to spend it all if they were actually going to leave town.
Okay, my terminology was way off. Not allocated. Mm-hmm. They couldn't spend it all.
Right.
I mean, they
can
spend
it
on a monthly increment.
Right. They can spend a monthly and budget it.
I'm not sure I'm still clear on the difference between the current state of affairs and what you are recommending. It would certainly be helpful for us to see in writing what you believe that the leadership, both of the House and Senate, have agreed to, and then if
that
it seems to meet our values, we could we support that.
I will draw my previous motion, and I'll say that I think, Ramona, at our next meeting, I think you can count on us enacting a resolution that will require, one, the legislative rules being enacted to require legislators to disclose the familial relationships of staff members they hire. So we'll take care of that problem, Dave. That was a good catch. And that, two, rules be enacted that you will give us some guidance on that will prohibit or prevent salary big adjustments going on, big increases going on. So.
That's pickle.
Yes.
And I apologize. I was watching you on television as I was getting ready to come up and speak on the training, and you brought this issue up, and as you were moving forward, I ran up the stairs to try to weigh in.
So
I will bring that suggested language to you at the next meeting, and you can review that.
To your knowledge, has Secretary Hall and the Senate advanced similar rules?
Because the Senate meets in executive appointments, and I won't speak directly for her, but they did adopt a rule change that their leadership had reviewed, and it does put the president in the position of it doesn't matter if it's a family member or not, that they must approve salary increases. And so I did give them a copy of my suggestion. They embraced it, but the train had already left town by the time I got there, and so I don't know if they will rethink it or not.
Well, can I ask at this point before Ramona leaves, too, and the way I'm hearing her say that is that it doesn't make a difference if it's a family member or relative, it's anybody, and then to also address Hasso's comment, I think that what she was saying is that if you're going to be retiring before the end of your term, they, you know, say you've got 6 months left, what they would do is back off 6 months, you know, based on what, and I know this is where I'm just thinking out loud here too, is if you have been paying the higher rate and it's going to run out, and you know, then it would just run out at that point, or if you were paying the lower rate, it would be based on what you've been paying, you know, on a monthly basis. Is that correct?
Representative Boone, I'm not sure I tracked you on that map there, but
I'm not sure I was tracking myself either for a minute there.
What I would suggest is that I think that I can outline for you at the next committee meeting sort of how this will all work and how the math will be done and what the language really looked like.
Yeah.
And that may help clarify, you know, what the recommendation is.
Too many clams, I think.
But, you know, even with all these math things and the monthly, and again, I think the concern that at least Commissioner Sheehan and I have is that family members are being paid beyond the work they're doing. And is that an issue that we can deal with, or is that such a subjective or objective thing that you're that's my concern, and the concern I think of the general public would be that Representative Smith has their daughter working for him, and she's getting paid this much money, and she never shows up to work.
Chairman Tim Chuck, short of requiring time sheets, and then having the member sign that timesheet to say that that person did report to work because they're only accountable to their appointing authority, which is the member, I'm not sure you get anything by going through those steps accomplished, except you have a signature on the line. But again, I think that, you know, and I'll just go back to my own experience. Before I got into this process and got paid real money, I worked for my father from the 1957 session up to about 1969, okay?
You were a fourth time a person. You were hired in 1957.
Close, yeah. But I would have to tell you that, and I believe it hasn't changed much, that if you work for your family member, as I did, your hours are not 8 to 5. Your hours are 24/7. You are dealing with that constituent that calls at 8 o'clock at night trying to make sure you have an answer for the legislator by the time they walk through the door so that they'll know what their options are when they return that call. You're taking phones. Now we have answering machines. We have emails. I would suggest that anybody working for our members are working hard. I don't know that anybody is getting a free ride. Otherwise, they wouldn't have the support they need to provide the constituent services necessary. And so, again, it depends on the member and what their needs are, but I'm not
although
sure.
I think the work situation with, you know,
I think that, you know, again, that was as it was reported, okay? I don't know that we can speak to how many hours her mother put in, okay? We do know that she gave her a huge increase going out the door, i.e. maybe a severance package. But my guess is that even as the mother, she was dealing with a lot of the constituent services necessary for Representative Worth, because as you know, Representative Worth was having some other challenges dealing with it.
Well,
I think our challenge is to try to take actions, large or small, that might increase public respect for the legislative body, and I think it is an issue. Maybe it's an issue largely of perception, but I think it is an issue that some people are being paid and don't live here or work here, and I'm not sure there's anything we can do about it, but I think I continue to hold that concern. I understand now the way you propose probably wouldn't deal with that at all, but if the chair and Marjorie could get what you're proposing sooner than at our meeting.
Absolutely.
Yes, we'll prior to our next meeting, so we can review it
for
us
ahead of time and perhaps consider if there's something in addition that we would want to recommend that would deal with our concern.
I'd ask Mr. Henderson, if you could perhaps, I don't know through any organizations you have, survey other legislatures, are there other legislatures that deal with this problem or have ways of dealing with this issue?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I emailed last week the table from the Oregon Law Commission, which shows that at least 19 states prohibit nepotism.
Right. Okay. So I'm talking about the ones that don't prohibit it. If there's a way that they deal with the salary adjustments or something like that, that would be helpful, I think, as well. So, well, we'll take just a little 2-minute break here, and then we'll go right to the training.
Okay, I think we'll go to the training first, so since we're here.
Okay.
We'll go to the training part of it, and step outside real quick. We'll start in 2 minutes. So if that whoever was on the training panel, if you want to get everybody in. So eloquently stated, to improve the perception or to improve the image of the Oregon legislature. That's the specific mission of this committee. Are there any ways that we could do that through the improvement of the training of legislators and legislative staff? And so with us today, with some thoughts, once again, are Dave Henderson, who's back here. He is, of course, the legislative administrator. Ramona stays with us. Jen Griggs is with the Department of Administrative Services Agency Training, and Jean Atkins with the House Democrats. Dave, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe you have in your packet a copy of the 2005 session staff training and orientation agenda. This is the first of, I'll say that we've got three tracks of training going on that are coordinated by legislative administration, and I say coordinated because all of the offices in the building participate, particularly in this training, which goes on. So while we coordinate it, it is definitely a joint effort with all of the offices, including fiscal, council, revenue, the chief clerk, the secretary of the Senate, the caucus offices, the presiding officers. Everyone's involved. This agenda is a two-day training that we do immediately prior to each legislative session. We invite legislative assistants to attend. Any personal staff to the members are invited to attend. The staff that work in the committee services office attend. Some of the staff who work in the chief clerk's office and the secretary of the Senate's office attend. It's really wide open to anyone who wants to participate. And it covers a broad variety of issues, from the structure of the legislative branch to how a piece of legislation is introduced, drafted, and goes through the process to become law. We go into some specific training about workplace harassment and things of that nature. We talk about our computer use policies, what is allowed and what is not allowed. So it's really, we try to present it in a way that is informative but also entertaining, so that we keep people involved and engaged for the entire 2 days. They have to do things like filling out their payroll forms. That's a requirement. We give building tours. We cover everything. You can look at the agenda. This is offered, as I said, for the 2 days right before the start of the session. We always get excellent attendance. Many people who have taken the training time after time after time, because there's always something new and different. So it's something that we believe to be very effective. We conduct a survey at the conclusion of the training to ask, was this effective? Was it not effective? What should we add? What should we take away? And we adjust the schedule every 2 years based on that input. We've got that going on. A parallel track to that is that we have put many training modules on our intranet site. We have training on there for various computer programs and a number of other basic issues that can be handled with somebody doing a point and click and watching a short video, or even just reading something online, as opposed to going and attending a training session. And one thing that we are just now, we have just completed, is really a two-year rolling biennial training process for all of our staff, because there are many things that that we train on and then we've forgotten about and we don't go back and touch, and you know, it'll go years and years and years. So there are some items on that biennial training schedule that now will be repeated every 2 years, and there are things that people will be required to attend, things that will be optional for people as well. So we've got the session training, we've got the online training, and then we've got the biennial training schedule, which we've just completed literally in the last few weeks. That's a very brief summary of the training activities that are coordinated through legislative administration.
Wasn't decided what is required.
Chair Timchuk, Commissioner Schutte, basically, I, as a legislative administrator, have decided that certain things are going to be mandatory, because I think that they're a benefit to all of our employees. There's other training that is mandated in House and Senate rules. So it's both a management decision and a decision based on the rules.
Okay. Thank you.
I imagine you can't really require anything of new legislators. They come here, but you can't make them attend something.
Commissioner Timchuk, Commissioner Herring, actually, sexual harassment training is required. There was a House resolution that was adopted. Ramona can fill you in on the details, but some of the training is required of the legislators as well. And we will literally do it during a floor session and have a call of the House or a call of the Senate to compel the attendance, and we'll have a sign-up sheet, and we check off that all of the members are there.
A question that I'll give fair warning to a lot of all of you and all of the Senate people, because you're the experts, is there anything that this committee could recommend in this area that you think would be helpful, that you think would begin in furthering the mission of improving the image of the Oregon legislature? Is there anything here that could be helpful? Or are we just talking about window dressing here? But I'd like to know if there's something that we need to recommend, and you guys are the experts, let's recommend it. If there's not, then there's not. So.
Chair Timchuk, I'd like the opportunity to ask among my managers if there's anything that we're missing that perhaps a motion out of your committee would be helpful to, and I could report back to your next meeting. Right off the top of my head, I don't think of anything. We take training very seriously, and we try to provide as many opportunities as possible for our staff because we know that there's a lot of turnover, things change. So it's something that we do pursue on an aggressive basis.
And especially if the legislature does eventually, as I think the full panel will recommend, move towards annual sessions, I think training becomes even more critical. So, Ramona?
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, let me just give you a quick overview of what has happened as far as training for the members. I think Dave talked about staff training. The House of Representatives obviously has the biggest influx of new members. The Senate maybe gets one, and they sort of join us. But with 20 new members typically, and when we're really under term limits, almost half of the membership was brand new. It has been traditional that the Monday following the election, that there will be a nuts and bolts training for all new members and returning members should they choose to return. And in that training, the major goal is to acquaint the new legislators with their new resources, any support agencies available to them. They will meet the other directors of the other offices like council, fiscal, revenue, administration. And then we go over basically how the process works very quickly. The most important part of that training, I think, is feedback from members of the House, what they wish they would have known. And we have a little round table with that, and they actually get very candid. But things that come out over and over again is what kind of effects is this going to have on you, on your family, on your, you know, your regular jobs, you know, what is your hours going to look like? And then we get down to the bottom line of the basics on how you're going to get appointed to a committee, you know, where's your office going to be assigned, how is it assigned, your chamber desks, your parking space, etc. That is really just the nuts and bolts. What I've learned over the course of all my years here is that we as professionals have so much information to share, we want to give them everything, and they can't absorb it. And so we've had to force ourselves to sort of step back and give them it in bite-sized opportunities. And because, you know, when you go back and you do a little survey or, you know, they can't remember everything you tried to feed them at the get-go. They just won their election. They've been on a hard campaign trail. And the last thing they're absorbing is a lot of the nuances of the process. What we've done to be able to sort of help them, and again, I'm in a nonpartisan office, so all my training, and you'll talk to the caucus office later, is about the process, about resources, about communication, about relationships. We have done various things over the course of the last 10 years. Some I think work very well, some have not been revisited for whatever reason, and some probably didn't work so well. In 1998, we did a partnership with Portland State University and Willamette University, and we had the members sort of go into those, both of those institutions, and really talk about, you know, whom do they represent, the many faces of Oregon. We had a demographic come in. We had somebody from three branches of government. We had the art of negotiation. We had them also work through, you know, how to work with the media, the federal government, all the real basics. That was not done a second year. In 2000, what we did was a little bit built on this, and I kind of like this, but it was expensive.
And I think with the budget woes we finally experienced, it became not a possibility. We actually, in the Senate's done it a couple times, but we actually took the members to McMinimins out of Forest Grove, where that they couldn't get anywhere close to a general population, and we kept them there for 2.5 days. And we had individuals like Justice Wally Carson talk, former member, about, you know, the institution, the traditions of Oregon. We had a session on negotiations and mediation. We have brought in experts from out of the state. You know, you're only an expert out of your state, never in your state. So we brought in a senator from Nebraska who's well known for that. We brought in National Conference of State Legislatures to help us in some roundtable exercises. We also had Representative Congressman DeFazio with Congressman Walden, opposite sides of the aisles, come in and talk about how it is important to work across, you know, the party divisions. And, you know, as you've heard over and over, you know, about partisanship in this institution, we really worked and focused on trying to build relationships with the individuals across party lines. Since we kept them there overnight, we had a couple social functions in the evening. One, they learned how to play pitch. That's a card game that has sort of been known as the legislative game. We had brought in a couple lobbyists, two or three lobbyists to sit at each table. Their role was not to lobby. Their role was to sit there and teach them the game of pitch. And people learned that they were married and had families and real lives, and it wasn't the person they thought they were on the campaign trail. I felt like at the end of that process, it was very valuable. But again, sometimes I think that it is challenging to put something like that together. We did pay per diem, or pay for the actual expenses of the members to go there, and they stayed. And we had, I think, only about maybe two or three members that did show up, and we're talking about all 60 members. We're not talking just new members, because it was important for the relationships not to be just across party lines for the freshmen, but across party lines and across, you know, interests and philosophics for the entire membership. We've done some, before, when term limits were in place, we've done some September training where we've taken the returning members seeking re-election to a brainstorming exercise up at Willamette Valley Vineyards. We put them through the Myers-Briggs so they can kind of learn about their personalities and why they don't get what the other guy says, maybe, or at least they can give them some sort of understanding. We've asked them for their goals. What do they think is needed in orientations and in the process? And let them just brainstorm. We've also done a full-blown week prior to session where we've asked agencies to come in and on based on subject matters, actually do 1.5, 2-hour sessions down in the hearing rooms, and they're scheduled on top of each other so you can pick and choose where you want to go, what you want to learn about, you know, what is that subject matter for your committee assignment that you might need to get, you know, a little bit of better understanding of. And we've also done chair training every session. The last session, the last two sessions, we've had a really hit in that we have spent a full day with Ken Rocco and Paul Warner, both fiscal officer and revenue officer, coming in and giving them the history of the budget of Oregon and how it's put together, and also the revenue picture, so that because those have been the big subject matters, they are not then just blind to what the Ways and Means Committee tells them they need to do. They actually have some sort of an understanding about what that looks like. And then last session, for the first time, I took the new members with some returning members, put them in a room, gave them house rules. We walked through the house rules, every single rule, and talked about when was it adopted, when was it changed, what is the intent, and why is it important to the process. And I that got really high marks, too. I think we do a lot of training. I think we could do better. But I think the time is of an issue, so with the new scheduled session, maybe starting later, we'll be able to see some of those opportunities to do some ramp-up training during that time between January and April. But at this point in time, I think we've tried a lot of various programs. I think we just need to kind of identify what really works and what doesn't work, and it depends on the personality, philosophy of the leadership, because they really do drive it.
Thank you.
besides a recommendation from this committee to do what works and to don't do what doesn't work, I mean, is there any other guidance that we can provide, any other recommendation that you see that would help?
Well, I think that the one thing that we try to do is ongoing training. You know, we just really give it to them all up front. And then we wait for an invitation to the tax offices, and typically I get it every once in a while, but I think it would be helpful for actually, aside from their caucus meetings, when maybe we have a motion for reconsideration come up, or the first conference committee, or where the deadline is looming for introduction of measures, that there's actually some, maybe a prepared program that would bring up other issues over and above just the process. That maybe the members would have interest revisiting or actually having an expansion on.
So we could recommend an expansion of training programs beyond the new legislature, new beginning of the session type of training.
Yeah, ongoing training throughout the entire legislative process, or as the dynamics change.
Move a little up on there. Good day, thanks.
Chair Tim Chuck, members of the Commission. My name is Shane Griggs. I'm Senior Policy Advisor to the Director of the Department of Administrative Services. One of my responsibilities is to coordinate that legislative training for the state agencies. And there are several reasons why we do that. Primarily, the governor expects state agencies to act in a professional and informed manner, and also to move in a direction that's compatible with his. So as you can imagine, with more than several state agencies, that does take a coordinated approach. We all need to be talking from the same script to be sure that that happens. Our half-day training is generally held that first couple of weeks, during the first couple of weeks of December, prior to the legislative session. Because of time limitations, it's historically only been a half a day, and because of those time limitations, we do assume that the attendees have at least a modicum of an understanding of the legislative process. So prior to that training, we do steer agencies to the online resources that are available. For instance, the How an Idea Becomes a Law that's posted on the legislative website is a great resource, as are several others on their sites. In 2004, to give you an idea, we had about 65 state agencies that participated in the half-day training at the Capitol. We also had overflow hearing room set up for that. And then we also offered it broadcasted live. So there were quite a few agency folks that I understood that participated or at least gleaned the information from their work site. In addition, about 2 weeks.
Are legislators invited to this training?
Oh, definitely. Okay. About 2 weeks following that, we also then put a streamed version of that training on the website. It is still on our website from the 2004. The intent there was that even though we're just a month prior to session, some staffing assignments have not been made in agencies. This gives agencies a resource for future training needs as far as what's going to happen during the legislative process. The handout of our agenda from 2004, I included a link to that in case you're just interested in seeing what that streamed version is. This year, we'll present topics similar to those, and again, we'll schedule it the first part of December. It takes a little bit of coordination. We rely heavily on these folks, Dave and Ramona and Judy, because we coordinate around their schedule for the trainings that are already being offered. I believe we tap some similar resources for presenters, and in fact, I tapped Ramona last time. So we have subject experts both from within state government and without, and from outside, and we've had members or presenters who have been not only legislative members, but have also held offices and leadership caucus offices and also are in the private sector. So we get a real wide spectrum of advice. It's all very good. They're all very familiar with the process. So I'd like to turn the tables around. If you have some suggestions that you would like us to incorporate in this year's training, we'd be glad to listen to those.
Well, I'm sure, you know, Pastor Gretchen, I can come and, you know, train you on the
protocol in the chamber.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Hello,
representative. And this is Jean, I'm Jean Atkins. I'm the caucus director for the House Democrats. So to just kind of complete the House loop here, and I don't think it looks terribly different on the Senate side, but obviously we have slightly different perspectives, as Ramona said, because of the number of members that are involved. And so anything that involves all 60 members is a whole different kind of training than in front of 30 members and that sort of thing. Dave's talked about the things that are provided by legislative administration, which I think are really important, and, of course, the legislative administration staff and what they get. I'd like to talk a little bit about filling in the gaps and sort of the comprehensive look at what members get, but also then focus a little bit about LAs, which are a very particular kind of staff because of how they come and go, because of their responsibility only to that member. They are quite part of the legislative administration permanent staff and don't necessarily have access to those things. And I do have some things that I'll put hopefully on your list for thinking about what you might do. I did provide you with a little bulleted set of things and an attachment, which I'll just describe briefly. I think the caucus offices, at least the ones that I have worked in, and of course every set of leadership that's elected out of their caucus has a different idea of what their members need and what they want their caucus office to do. So that may be one of our problems, is that we don't sort of always have consistency over time. But we are focusing on assuring that members and their staff have a comprehensive view of their roles and responsibilities, which are often much more complex than they think walking in the door. We rely on and are very dependent upon the chief clerk's office and what legislative administration provides for the nuts and bolts of being on a committee, being a member on the floor, that sort of specific legislative activity. But as a member, they have a responsibility to all of their constituents, to provide constituent service, to do constituent communications. They have press relationships that they need to deal with. They have a whole range of things that aren't necessarily covered in that nuts and bolts and how to, you know, be a member in the body. And that's part of what then we sort of try to wrap around what their responsibilities might be. In a previous time that I appeared before one of the commission's committees, somebody sort of indicated, why would members need help being effective? These are people who've gotten themselves elected. They've done, you know, they usually have some, you know, good background because, you know, people were willing to vote for them. Why would they need, you know, help with any of these things? And I'd say that every member comes with a certain set of skills and a certain set of gaps because of the nature of being a legislator is such a broad set of responsibilities. Some of them have been in business and supervised a million people, and hiring in LA and supervising them is, you know, is nothing to them. They need no help from us around that. Other people may come out of a venue where they've never supervised anybody in their life, and that's just a little gap in their background and understanding a little bit about how to hire, how to manage, how to deal with a disciplinary problem. I mean, there's all kinds of things that can come up that an individual member may need help with, and it's kind of our job, because we want them to be effective, you know, to cover those things. One of the attachment that I gave you is we do manuals. A predecessor of mine started this process. I think it's really important. Partly because they get so much information at the beginning, they need tools to use all through, you know, that they can refer back to, and we can help them. Yes, you have something about that. You know, here's a how-to or the 10 most important things to remember when you're putting on a town hall. You know, that we have tools for them to use, and so I've given you the table of contents for the two, both the member manual and the legislative assistant manual that we give to our members that we gave this last time. We'll be updating and revising, obviously, for the next session. You'll see that they're very parallel. We're telling the member and the legislative assistant, you know, this is how to think about what you're doing and the pieces of your job, and here are some tools to help you with that. We obviously help to work with freshman legislators more than anybody else because they're the ones who haven't been around the block. We do, as part of our leadership team direction, have a mentor program within the caucus where they each are assigned somebody who's an experienced legislator when they are new and come in. We help in the caucus office to facilitate that and make sure that they're in some communication where we can. We have a process of meeting with the legislative assistants frequently during session. Almost always in any caucus office, you're going to have at least one person who's been a legislative assistant for a long time. Quite often, that's a legislative assistant to the leader. In our case, Representative Merkley's longtime legislative association associate, Claire Griffin, took responsibility for, and virtually every month would have a brown bag lunch with legislative assistants and bring them an agenda of a variety of things, help them keep on top of things, bring me in to talk, bring Ramona in to talk, bring, you know, try to keep them on top of things. Legislative assistants can really get left in the dust if they're not, if you don't have something, some way of communicating from them directly. We also do sort of following up on the trainings that are giving at the beginning, try to use the permanent staff in the building to help folks with various briefings. We're just at the moment in contact with Legislative Revenue Office. We expect the school funding formula to be an issue next session, so we try to use interim time and have them perhaps come just on an invitation basis. Members can come and sort of go over those issues and see what they are. And because we're in sort of constant contact with our members, we know where there's a gap, where people are asking a lot of questions, where they're asking for a lot of research when we bring somebody in. So those are the kind of things that we do. And how might the commission help us? Since you gave that, I'll think about that. You've heard all day today, I think, in a number of different ways, some of the challenges of knowing so much about so many issues and so many things that these members need. And there is very little money in their own budget or money in the legislative budget to provide, you know, a lot of training. Every state agency has this problem, and I certainly understand as much as anyone what the budget limits are. But recommending that, you know, it's appropriate to get per diem for going to something when you're trying to get yourself better trained. The sort of public perception that it's bad for them to go to conferences, it's bad for them to go to NCSL because it's in a nice hotel in a nice city and legislators shouldn't be using. That just sort of contradicts the notion that you want members and you want staff who know what they're doing and have, you know, and are well trained. State agencies all through have that problem, and so I recognize the challenge around it. But I think you could help us by trying to take a little bit of the onus off of members when they try to use their resources to get their training. I think it might be a very useful thing if we could take the job of legislative assistant a little more seriously and think about a way. Whether we can actually create professional salaries for that particular group, I don't know. It may not be possible, but we could certainly think about how to make that a good professional step in a career, which it is for many young people coming right out of college. It's often a very good initial place to work if they're interested in politics or interested in public policy. And they really are at the mercy of a member who may or may not be thinking about helping them do a good job in addition to, you know, the member themselves doing a good job. And they are often here for a very short time. They're often hired right in the middle of the two-day training, you know, so they don't even get there for the first day because they haven't been hired yet. There's a real crunch for them in terms of being able to get the skills they need to do a good job. And our system, I don't think, supports them very well except out of the caucus offices. And I'm glad we've taken that on as a responsibility because I think it's an important one in that regard. So perhaps something along that line. I think also recommending that we use the modern technology that we have. I mean, we've been very glad that legislative administration has started to create intranet available, because you have a new LA come in 3 weeks into the session and they've got to understand measure tracking. Thank God, you know, there's something on the web that they can do, because you can't organize a new training on measure tracking every 3 months. So continuing to use the tools, the newest tools of training, I think is going to be really important. Again, it's a resource issue. I understand that. But if we value it, we need to invest in it, and that would be my recommendation to you.
Any questions from anyone else?
Well, it seems to me that there is so much training going on, it's hard to see how they get any work done. And it's hard, really, to see that what else might be done. It seems to me that this outline is numbing as complexity and volume. But I have no questions. I'm impressed with all this stuff because I didn't realize that all that stuff was going on. I do know, I did realize that after being elected, our legislators disappear for a while, and I figured that must be what they're doing.
we had, you know, this committee or commission, all the committees and commission are evaluating every proposal we receive, and as you know, we receive boatloads of them, and many, if not most, of the proposals are, I think, in the category that I would describe as micromanaging. Asking the committee to recommend that, you know, employ that focus on early planning. We delegate planning for new member, you know, and all these little sort of things. And that's not our job. I don't think any of the committee members do. That's why I was asking you on a larger level, is there anything we can recommend beyond a general encouragement and attaboy of the training? And so if each of you would think about that, too, and report back to Marjorie if there's any specific proposal that we can make that you think would improve the image and the work of the legislature, that would be helpful to this committee. So we've got the Senate staffers here now, I think, to come on up. And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just want to call attention to the big packet from Judy Hall, Secretary of the Senate. She's provided a copy of the Senate Leadership Institute.
David, Ramon, if I could ask you to stay for about 5 more minutes, too. I think we might need your help in the next issue after this.
The Leadership Institute from 2005, when all of the senators were over at Willamette working on issues over there. She included the agenda, a survey, the survey results, and some of the materials that were handed out at that time.
Very helpful. And again, welcome to the committee. And would ask you also to focus on the question that I asked of the past panel. Is there anything that we can recommend that you think would improve the legislature? And I know Rick. The other two, I don't know. So if you want to introduce yourselves and proceed. So.
My name is Rick Thomas. I'm caucus administrator for the Senate Republican Caucus. You want to go individually?
Just introduce yourself real quick so we know who you are.
My name is Carol Suzuki, and I am the operations director for the Senate Majority Office.
Okay.
My name is Tim Markwell. I usually just come back during sessions to train the Democratic legislative assistants.
Okay.
Well, as far as legislator training, the Senate's kind of a different animal, and we're lucky that we benefit from the House being, by and large, the training ground for the Senate. I look back as I was preparing to come up here, and Carol and I were talking a little bit beforehand, but since 1998, there have only been 3 senators who did not have previous service in the House. And so a lot of the individual member training ends up being fairly focused and specific, and individual members who come in each case, it's just been one new person each of those times. And so they've got a great deal of kind of highly specialized and specific training. I know that Judy Hall spends about a day just answering questions with individual freshmen, the last 2 cycles at least, just kind of answering their questions, bringing them up to speed on a one-on-one basis on protocol of the Senate structure and how kind of the processes work within the Senate. And so kind of just from there, move on to staff training side. After each of the legislative assistants, by and large, just spent about a day and a half in training that like Dave's talked about, and others just on the overall building functions and how all the different statutory committees like legislative, fiscal, and revenue work. We do spend about a half day with the staff of the individual legislators, just walking through and kind of touching on some of the things that the rest of that process doesn't get to or that are just specific in working with the caucus office and kind of outlining how things can work and how we can be a resource to them. We go ahead and go through with them the roles of the different leadership offices, since that's one of the things that they haven't gone through yet. You know, who are the point people in the different leadership offices? How does that system interrelate with their job? You know, where they can go for information and whatnot. We also, you know, help them to understand the importance of outreaching back to their community, to their districts, give them some pointers and some information on how to do that, everything from how to set up a town hall, like Gene mentioned, to other basics, general formats for correspondence with constituents, just some stylistic issues. We also try to spend a decent amount of time, though, on scheduling as well, helping them understand basics of scheduling legislators, how to keep them running on time, how to manage their time, you know, increments of time to try to schedule things in, just to help them make their members successful in their process. And in their committees and whatnot. But over the course of the session, we also try to get back with them. We do some brown bag series over the usually about once a month, over the course of the session, bringing them in, ask them, you know, what are some of the questions that they as staff are having, what are some of the major issues that they're facing, and try to identify ways that we can help them with those challenges, and try to provide them as well just information on some of the major pieces of legislation that are going through, things that they can use in their day-to-day life. And then also after session, try to provide them some of those similar resources as well, so that as they go home and they're away from the Capitol, train them and give them the different information that they'll need to service their constituents when they're away from the building. To answer Chairman Tim Chuck's question, you know, by and large, if there's something that we're not doing, it's probably because we haven't thought of it. And so I guess I kind of go back to what Gene had said as well, that you know, if there's something that you guys perceive is something that you think our members can benefit from, I think all of us by and large are open to trying to incorporate that in the training that we do. If we're not doing it, it's usually just because of something we haven't thought of or something that somebody hasn't brought up in the past. Thank you.
Thanks.
Again, my name is Carol Suzuki, and I'm the operations director for the Senate Majority Office. And my job in the caucus office is to basically oversee the day-to-day operational and procedural functions of the office, and also help to train staff in general office operation and legislative protocol. I think it's been helpful for me that I've worked here in the Capitol building for 12 years. And I started out as an intern in the 93 session. In the 95 session, I was a legislative assistant to a state senator. So coming from that background, I think it's been particularly helpful to know as a caucus office staffer how to best help these people, oftentimes people that have just come straight out of college or right off of a campaign, because obviously that's significantly different. And so as Rick and other speakers have mentioned, we provide basically a half-day training to supplement the training offered by legislative administration, basically introducing them to staff, building relationships, and how best to work with the caucus office. And then throughout the legislative session, I serve as one of the primary liaisons to both caucus members and to legislative staff, you know, based upon my experience working here in the building, who to contact to get your answer the quickest, that kind of thing. But starting in about 1997 is when we, in the Senate Democratic office then, and now the Senate Majority office, have been working to develop a program that trains our legislative assistants, and I will let Tim Markwell talk to that.
Thank you. I guess most people kind of covered the nuts and bolts.
Thing again, that's going to be our recommendation about four of these, and one of these. Okay.
Since most people kind of covered the nuts and bolts, I'll try to give you a little bit more of a flavor of the training, I think. I started in 1991. When I came, there was really no formalized training program. I was a little bit older than the other LAs. I was 33 years old, but like Carol said, some of them were just coming out of college. They had never had worked a job before, or they had come off a campaign and kind of thought this was the same thing as a campaign, and it's not at all. I was just overwhelmed by the fact that here we are in just this short six-month period making laws that are going to affect citizens of Oregon, and here are people that aren't being supervised, essentially, aren't being trained, essentially, and they're working 10 hours a day. They're working 6-7 days a week. I saw definitely something was wrong with that picture. So I looked around at who looked like they knew what they were doing. There was a lady by the name of Kathy Rock, who had been here forever. And basically I said, teach me what you know. And I started a notebook. And then after the 91 session ended, I went and I worked for three different congresspeople. And their offices aren't much more organized, and there's not that much more training, unfortunately, either. And so it became very apparent to me that you need to facilitate change, especially when you're in a pressure cooker environment. This environment here, once it gets going, you get into April and May, it's hard to remain objective. And also you need the basic foundation to have the tools to learn how to do your job, and you got to have some support in that. Essentially, my experience has been is that LAs really weren't supported. I don't know if this is a fair comparison, but it's kind of the doctor and nurse thing. A lot of people really don't realize sometimes who does a lot of the groundwork, who does a lot of the grunt work. And as Gene Atkins said, I think legislative assistants are very undervalued. I think the average citizen doesn't have much of a conception of what they do. I think most senators coming in until they've had a session or two under their belt really realize what these people do for them. My position and the way that the Senate Democrats are set up is a little bit different than the other offices. I'm kind of an outsider. I run a small private business outside of here. I come in for about 3 or 4 months during the beginning of session to train these people. And so I'm not always, while I'm part of the caucus, I'm kind of viewed a little bit more as a liaison. But I'm here just for them. Unlike the other offices, if they're caucus administrators, communications director, I am just here to do the training. And so I start off probably just a couple weeks at the beginning of session, but very quickly then I'm down to 3 days a week. And I'm usually only here till about April. But it's, you know, again, it's amazing to me, if there isn't somebody like me, how a lot of things get done. I mean, all of you have worked positions where you know there's a supervisor that makes sure things are happening, that check to see if things are happening. A lot of times that doesn't happen. And again, as was brought up, a lot of the senators, while they're good in some areas, they really lack some basic managerial skills. The senators are taught to be partisan, but I mean, the first thing that we do in our orientation is we turn and say, you were elected, you know, in your district by certain people, but now that you are elected, you represent all of those people in that district. You know, if you look at most of the bills that are passed here, it's not real close. You know, it's not like 16 to 14 that often. You know, you'd be amazed how many of the bills here are 28 to 2. And you know, there's a lot more work that goes on here and a lot more partnering than I think people give credit for. And that's one of the things we really try to set out in our training to do. We have a couple forums with the Republican staffs, and that had never been done before. We also go over and see the Senate Democrats at this point in time. You would be amazed at how many senator staff don't know the staff of the representatives that are in those districts. So building relationships is something that's very important. But supporting these people, I think, is the biggest thing. What I wanted to do is just kind of read you a little bit of a list here real quick of some of the presentations that we have. Again, these legislative assistants are working on PERS issues. They're the ones sometimes that are meeting with the lobbyists. They're the ones that are meeting with the constituents. They are the people that talk to the senator more than anybody else. There hasn't been any training for these people on a lot of these issues if the caucuses weren't doing it. And I mean, just think how big the PERS issues is. And if, you know, if that kind of training wasn't available for them. We train them on the media. We train them on education. We had Measure 37. We had a couple speakers in on the Oregon Health Plan. We had Dr. Goldberg come in on that. We had PERS, naturally, because that was a big issue. Public records, that became a very big issue the last session. We had a lot of things on that. We bring in Judy Hall's office to be able to talk to them about timelines and rules and procedures. And then also we bring in the senators now and then for them to kind of update the staff about what's going on. I think what I will end with is I think another training aspect is to help break the pressure that these folks are under here. One of the things I always have them do is go outside, stop a person on the street and ask them if they know if the Oregon legislature is in session. You'd be amazed how many, no, we didn't know you were there. Kind of helps them put that. It doesn't minimize what they're doing, but it helps them get out of a certain frame of mind.
Maybe heavy trainings in the public.
that may be a good thing. But I think my suggestion would be is that this commission relate to the legislators that training is a priority. While it may sound like there's a lot of training, when you look at the amount of time that they're here and that they spend, it's really not that much. And so I don't know if more money can follow with that, but my biggest thing would just be that you state this as a value.
Thank you. Any questions or comments?
So I want to understand you're speaking particularly about LAs.
Yes.
Well, I guess what we heard from one of the previous presenters was per diems for training. LA is having professional salaries using the internet, and now the concerns that you have addressed with both supervision and training and individual known recognizable person to provide training but also support for LAs, particularly in an early period. What would that take to address any and all or any of these issues? I'm not sure how we would make a recommendation.
That would be a couple more meetings.
Yeah.
I can see, you know, and I don't want to.
Salary levels are another committee, so yeah.
And I don't want to take away from the other personal staff, sometimes called an administrative assistant. They play dual roles,
right,
and they balance back and forth. And our orientation is with all staff, but then after that, it's just the legislative staff. But it's a very thin line between what their duties are. So I want to make sure I don't exclude them and their valuable contributions.
Are you making a recommendation that the kinds of things you think are important and maybe not valued enough should occur somewhere else, not from the caucuses?
I think some of it could, but I think, you know, because we are in a partisan environment, because there's how a bill becomes a law and then there's the way how a bill really becomes a law, that
You can't tell us about that.
In a nonpartisan manner, and there's a lot of strategy that's kind of proprietary. So I think some of it can be general. I think more of it could be generalized among the caucuses, but some of it I do think it's more proprietary and just akin to that particular caucus and that particular party.
It sometimes happens to me that when I talk to assistants at the legislature, of our legislators, on the telephone, I'm stunned by how little they know about the district. Sometimes they don't know what towns are in the district, and what really is insulting is when they don't know my name. So I'm wondering to what extent training of legislative assistants involves getting to know the home district. Are they required to spend some time there, drive around a couple of weeks, visit the Rotary Club, that kind of thing?
I know that kind of defies logic to a certain extent that they don't know that, but unfortunately you may have somebody that's working for a Corvallis senator that's from Portland. That happens a lot of time. It's a matter of who's available. We do, at least the Senate Democrats do, have a district profile book that would have listings of you, you know, what you do, the newspaper you're with, what the cities are, who the mayors are, you know, who the city council people are, and we tell them to familiarize themselves with that. Some do and some don't, but we try to make sure that they do that, but unfortunately there's not always that connection. Some people during session keep a separate person, separate legislative assistant in the district that just does constituent work. So, if, you know, as you were talking about staffing arrangements, they're just all over the map when you look at each senator's staff.
To the extent that we try to affect that, not just the actual work of the legislature, but the public perception of it, it does make a very bad impression for somebody to be calling from Sweet Home to the Senate office and they. Where is that? You in this district? That's what I mean. I mean, it seems to me that it would make a lot of sense to require, or to, at least for the caucus offices, to make it a regular thing to ask legislative assistants of all kinds to maybe take a couple of weekends and drive around the place and drop in at various coffee shops and just.
It's a good idea,
that sort of thing.
It's also a test of the competence of the members for them to make sure they have someone in their staff who knows how to pronounce the cities in their district. So,
or visit their local
community.
Or visit their local community.
Or visit
their local
community. Yeah, yeah. Okay. So, other questions? Well, thank you very much, all of you. Fellow committee members, I think, you know, beyond a general, and Mr. Henderson is going to report back to us later with anything his staff might have, but beyond a general recommendation that encouraging House and Senate leaders and legislative administration to continue efforts to provide the most up-to-date and innovative and bipartisan training possible, I'd be getting more delves into the micromanaging level. I don't think there's anything there that really demands our attention. Is there a disagreement? Or
no, I agree.
Okay, all right. And that brings up the light. Are you still with us, Debbie?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Just shout out if there's anything, you know, if there was.
I will.
Okay.
It's been very interesting.
Dave and Ramona, I asked to stay behind because the last item on our agenda this morning
fell into the, I think almost last, I said in the next meeting, fell into the similar thing for me, which is we received a lot of proposals on public access. A lot. Recommendations from, and again, many of them fell into the very minor micromanaging level, requiring 48-hour notice, requiring, reminding legislators to ask people who drove the farthest to go first, to ask the legislature to hold more hearings outside the building, to ask them to hold more hearings inside the building, to ask them to hold more hearings on Tuesdays, to ask them to hold, you know, a lot of proposals at that level, and I provided you with the list. Is there anything in there that you think, demands our attention or that would really make a difference? I mean, so much of it is, in our view, I think, common sense. I mean, being nice to guests and being nice to witnesses and paying attention to those who travel the furthest. And
I'll jump in here and just make a suggestion that since we've been talking so much about training, maybe chairs and vice chairs could have, if they don't already have, some sort of mentorship or training for just the usual, like you said, common sense items when leading a committee. And just those, the very things you were saying, but, you can't legislate common sense, unfortunately, although I do have a bill drafted for that. But I think that most often it's done as, most of the chairs I've ever worked with have been as accommodating as they possibly can. And it is incumbent on the public, if they're interested in a bill, to make, to take some responsibility for that and work with their representative or senators and do whatever they can to help them, and those representative senators can do whatever they can to help them manage this process, short of moving to Salem for the period.
Exactly. Hey, Ramona, based on the list I gave you, anything there that stands out?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Dave Henderson. As Ramona and I read through this list, I think the interesting thing about this list is that we do virtually everything
that's
on this list.
Also,
perhaps what we need to do a better job is marketing ourselves for doing these things. It is, I believe, and Ramona can correct me if I'm wrong, it's in committee rules that anyone who has traveled more than 100 miles should be invited to testify first. More opportunities for public involvement. Tying back into the training issue that we were talking about earlier, we conduct a training session for members of the public prior to the start of the legislative session, where we invite members of the public to come in and we will teach them how to use our internet site, how to testify before a committee. We have a video that we have produced that we show to groups on a regular basis of how to testify before a committee.
It's publicized on your website?
Yes, it is. And we've got what's called a quick card, which is just a quick reference sheet that instructs people on how to testify. We do conduct both telephone conference hearings that allow people to testify by telephone, and we conduct video conference hearings where people can testify by video. That's usually at the request of the chair or a member of the committee, but we're always happy to set up the equipment that we have to do those things. So I just think as a general statement, we do many of these things, but we just haven't done a good job of telling people that we do them, I think, at times.
Ramon, anything to add?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe that over the last probably 6 to 10 years, we've really taken seriously trying to bring the public into the process, because it's really about their participation in a citizen legislature. We have gone from a short notice time frame, 24 hours, to 48 hours. And also, we have kept that in place for public participation up through the final days of session. What does get expedited in the final days, which I think gives sometimes the legislature a little bit of a bad rap, is the work sessions. Work sessions have to have 24 hours during regular session time, or 48 hours, but then once we find that we're going home, supposedly within the next couple weeks, and we need to move the agenda to kind of close this place down, then meetings can be held with notice posted on the House side, on our information board, and also on the Senate with 1 hour notice.
But that is after public testimony has been taken. And usually it might be in the other house that that information was taken, but those records are made available to the members on the other side, because the fact that we have two houses has got to go through both sides. I do think sometimes the legislature gets a little bit of a bad rap because it doesn't look like we give a lot of notice. Most committees, we print and have online the schedules of all the committees by bill number, with a summary of those bills, and by numerical order in the back of this publication. And it's published on Thursday night and distributed on Fridays and or mailed, made very available. And usually the committees will have a week's notice in there. Sometimes judiciary, you can look in the 3 weeks, you know, notice out there. They do change. You do need to check. But it's not like everybody waits just to get 48 hours notice. One thing that was on here again, and it was the recommendation on maybe more public meetings or forced public meetings on budget negotiations or work groups. And I would suggest that, like any business, like any other organization, there is a time when the stakeholders and a couple legislators need to get into a room and hash out where the differences are, but they can't make any decisions. No quorum is ever allowed in that room, and they must report back to the full committee what they have found. To suggest that with the number of bills that are introduced in this process and finally makes it through the entire process in the short amount of time we really do meet, although it seems longer over the last couple sessions, without that opportunity, those would be hashed out in public, and a lot of time would be spent on those issues, and other issues may not be addressed. And so I have found where on some issues, i.e., and I can't think of anything right off, but I know that when the Oregon Health Plan, because that's a while back, and I think I'm safe on that one, was really being hammered out, that was being done in a workroom. But once it was brought into the public view, then it was hashed out in the public and lots of public input. So there are value to work groups. And I don't know that they're closed. We just don't require minutes to be taken. We do, though, however, make sure that no quorum is present at those meetings, because that would be in violation of the Constitution.
You do a press release, Dave, at the beginning of each session from Legislative Administration saying, here's the website, here's the...
Mr. Chair, yes, we do. And if I could just for a second go back to a couple of the other items on the list. There are several items about having more hearings outside of Salem. The presiding officers in the last few years have really pushed for that, and both during the interim and during session. And so we have conducted hearings in, you know, all corners of the state, and invited public participation at those. So it is something that the leaders have taken seriously and are really encouraging of their committee chairs.
I would ask committee members, again, besides maybe a general recommendation praising the public access and how well Oregon does and urging them to continue to do it, anything here on the list that floats anybody's boat for moving forward? Or?
No, but I do think it's very, very important we do weigh in, even though I think it must be in a general way. I mean, if we don't have as a sizable part of the final report of the whole commission that... known and predictable patterns and ways for the public to directly access the process, we've got to reinforce that in as specific ways as we can, and even to some extent referencing notice, opportunities for public testimony, use of the technology. I think we need to
continue to focus on and
never to let it lapse, to be sure to have, you know, a process that ensures that the specific strategies are constantly reviewed for their use and for public concern about how they are used.
Okay.
I think there is
something that I think would improve the legislative work in terms of public access or public or visibility to the public of what is being done. Well, two things at least. One of them has to do with the way that bills are reported or recorded by the legislature itself, and it's not even on this list, and I'm sorry I really not thought of this, although I thought about it from time to time, but instead had thought of bringing it up. And that is the business about the relating clause. I mean, there are bills, for example, that especially later on in the session, that have no summary at all, except to say that it relates to such and so, and they just don't have summaries. I think there ought to be a requirement that nothing can... I don't even know if this is sensible or, I mean, it's feasible. But I've looked for bills as a citizen wondering what happened to that, and I just mm-hmm. and you just can't find them. I mean, because it's just...
The number. Mm-hmm. Is it feasible?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Herring, I think that it will be, okay? And the reason why I believe it hasn't been is that we have started a transition with technology. And I think it was about, 6 years ago? 6 years ago, we started moving from what's called the mainframe that had been in this building since 1974 and started transitioning into new technology. The last component of that transition is legislative council. And legislative council is still on the old mainframe in the development of the legislation. And so it has been very difficult, and it's been a concern of mine. And actually, I can tell you I've done every job in the clerk's office, and one of my jobs was, before I became chief clerk, was to do the schedule. And I actually keyed in every word in the schedule. We now have been able to strip out certain pieces of information. But what is in the bill content and what that summary up there that shows what the bill is doing today and what's been deleted and what's being added is not available. So someone would have to rekey that at this point in time to get it. So we have sort of gone to the short summary version of the first 286 characters, and that's all limited by technology. Council is now under negotiations with a vendor to move into the new 21st century with their technology, and that information then will be readily available. And hopefully, Commissioner Herring, you will not have such frustrations as try to figure out what the bill does, because we will replace then in the schedule and in our notices what the bill actually does and not necessarily the relating to clause. It's possible. It's not possible without more staffing at this point in time.
I think we ought to make a recommendation that this change be accelerated or that it be carried out mm-hmm. with no undue delay, without delay.
Yeah.
Dave? Mr. Chair, I apologize. I neglected to tell you probably one of the most exciting things that we have going on as far as public access. We have been in negotiation for quite some time, legislative administration through our legislative media office, with Oregon Public Broadcasting, Southern Oregon Public Television, and the Oregon Public Affairs Network. And we have arrived at an agreement whereby on January 8th of next year, we will launch the Oregon Channel, which will be available through OPB and SOPTV, not as broadly as statewide at this point, but ultimately when the digital build-out is completed, we believe there will be a 24/7 channel available to somewhere on the order of 90% of the residents of the state. Because of the move to digital, that allows the public broadcasters to help us to provide information to folks so that we will carry live, unedited coverage of floor sessions and committee meetings, and we will tape delay other meetings so that anyone, whether they're in Astoria or Ontario or wherever they may be, we'll be able to tune in on a daily basis to see what is going on here at the Capitol. During the session, it will be largely legislative coverage. During the interim, we will incorporate coverage of board and commission meetings such as this, assuming we move forward. Now, that's a pilot project at this point. We do need some funding right now. We're working to be able to carry this out through the session without any additional funding. The long-term build-out costs for OPB and Southern Oregon Public Television are not insignificant, but certainly a resolution out of your committee supporting the furtherance of that would be very good, and I know it's in front of another one of the committee's
already that I believe Marjorie is pointing out to you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we actually have a recommendation scheduled for discussion on Monday in the full commission regarding the Oregon Channel.
Something that struck me as we were talking about that great news and also all the other really good avenues that there are for public access is again what you said also, they, you know, do people know it? Can we do a better job? There's probably some really humble ways to let people know. I can't think what they would be, but just to use an example from the college, we finally put pedestals that say where you are and how you get from here to there, and if you need information for who is, what are the phone numbers to call, and just on the walkways as you come to the college. Just when people come to the Capitol, that one time that they happen to be coerced into coming to testify, it was really obvious, you know, somewhere when you walk in the door. Yeah.
Very obvious, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. You go to that little stand down in the middle and they point you in the right direction?
Yeah.
Right.
But I mean, to be aware of the website, to be aware of this new televised opportunity. But
well, thank you both for staying late after school. And if you need a note from me, I'll give you a note to show your sister, your bosses, but you're your own bosses. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Supervisors.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, Administrator Taylor and I think we're moving fairly quickly to disposing of all the work and proposals before this committee. From my records here, the next meeting we will revisit the intergovernmental affairs matter, dispose of that once and for all, unless Chair Fryer puts herself in front of the train on that one. We have taken care of the alcohol policy. We will pass something on the nepotism policy after Clerk Kennedy will report back to us on that. Public access, I would just maybe ask committee members to review the list one more time and to come up with some suggestions for a general recommendation on that and on training that we can adopt at the next meeting, and then we will dispose of all the minor proposals. And I think that would complete everything before us, wouldn't it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I provided some suggestions for you to consider to just cross everything off the list. We do have to probably meet with the Oregon Law Commission on ethics. Maybe just chat with them briefly.
Okay.
Then you have a couple proposals related to bills and amendments, but I wouldn't suggest that you take that up until the process committee finishes their comments on bills and amendments. And then also, we have those two very general proposals in committee, which are kind of strange in that one says preserve the citizen legislature, the second one is professional legislature, full-time, fully compensated, fully accountable members. So I don't know if
you either of those really belong in our committee or belong in others, so I think we
well exactly, and is there some way that you can just move them up to the full commission basically for some sort of recommendation from them? Maybe that's more appropriate.
Well, I would think perhaps in our next meeting we will discuss issues we need to discuss, the ones that I've mentioned, and then similarly execute all other proposals before the committee. So, any other thoughts or?
No, I think the only other concern that I expressed from time to time is this whole general area of how the legislature and the people of Oregon work together and work against each other sometimes. Is that I think there's a statute that says that laws, that bills must be written in plain language. But in fact, that's much of the language is plain only for the lawyers who write it.
That isn't our lawyer's mind.
Yeah. So I think, I don't know if this committee or the entire commission has much of a role in that question at all. But if you ever read Oregon statutes, I mean, they simply are written so as not to be understood. I mean, that's the purpose of them, I think. And I think that if that were ever to change, a great burden would have been lifted from this relationship of the people of Oregon to their lawmakers, because they would understand and each other much better. And so somewhere along the line, I think we ought to stress once again
that
the letter of this law be obeyed,
right?
Observed.
Okay.
And I can't remember what the statute is, but
yeah, well, Minister Taylor will check that out, and
we'll get it.
Put that also on the.
I think that's very important.
Yeah.
Someone who depends on the receiving end of, for example, clinical 342, clinical 300, and how do we implement those? Can you agree with that?
Representative Boone, do you think we need to add for the next agenda what will possibly be our last meeting?
Boy, not right now, but I will certainly let Marjorie know.
Okay. And we'll ask Mr. Fryer and Mr. Yoshida to do the same. So.
Great.
Only one more meeting?
Unless Marjorie thinks I'm wrong, I think we can easily get rid of everything by one more meeting. Yeah, she's nodding her head, too. Yeah, we'll be the first committee to close up and get an award or something. So
I don't know. We might get another one closed before that.
Yeah, apparently it might close.
Then you would be free to work on other issues.
Mm-hmm.
With the committee, you can show up at other meetings if you want to.
Yes,
exactly. We're more than welcome to do that.
And I invite Mr. Taylor to, through email, visit our calendars and our schedules and suggest a few possible dates. And do we want to wrap it up in June? Do we want to... before the summer hits full blow? Okay.
Try for June. Okay.
Any objections to getting ready? Try for June. And
we can try for June.
Bend down.
By the way, we do have a full commission meeting coming up on Monday. Hopefully everybody's planning to be there.
It's possible to be there by phone.
We can do that.
I'll talk to you. So.
We can do
that. I'll be there.
Okay.
Only one more parking
space. Okay. We'll be there. Absolutely.
No further business? Okay.